and welcome to Worlds Apart. The ability to forecast and steer global development in its favor has long been one of the West's main competitive advantages, allowing it to ride the wave of ever-increasing influence until 2009, when the global financial crisis pushed the United States to set up G20 to split the damage and led the BRICS leaders to come together for the first time to advance the common good. 15 years on, which of these two formats looks more viable or more attractive to the rest of the world? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Paulo Nogueira, a Brazilian economist and former executive director at the International Monetary Fund. Mr. Nogueira, it's good to see you again. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, you've had a very interesting career, having served in the old style, that is, Western-dominated financial institutions like the IMF, and also being associated with the new age groupings like BRICS New Development Bank. I wonder if you find the IMF experience in any way helpful to sort of observing what's happening with BRICS these days.
In many ways, yes. If I were to select one thing that I learned from my experience of 8 years in Washington in the IMF, it is that the current international monetary and financial system dominated by the United States and its allies, it's unreformable. The system is rigid. It's rigidly controlled. It has become, when I say the system, I mean the IMF, the World Bank, the Federal Reserve, the dollar itself, the SWIFT payment system. All this has become a set of geopolitical instruments that the West uses routinely and aggressively to intimidate, restrict, and, you know, dominate other countries. So this is my experience in the fund. I fought a lot to reform the fund. I spent years and years doing that. And we did achieve some things in the context of what you just mentioned, the financial crisis, when the West was weak. It sort of made some concessions. But since 2010, well, since 14 years, the whole structure of the fund has been frozen.
Now, how do you understand that? Because you've written a lot about the weaponization of these institutions hurts the reputation and ultimately comes back to bite the West itself, because the West has used these tools to its own advantage. How do you understand the logic of doing these mutually exclusive things?
You're right. You put it well. I mean, this is, I believe, a symptom of the decay of the West. The West is still very powerful, of course, hegemonic, but it is a declining force. And the declining force misuses the instruments it has. I always say that if we want to change things, we have at least one important ally if we want to change the dollar system. This important ally is the United States, because it continuously undermines its own currency, misusing it.
Yeah, a lot of people are joking about it, but it undermines it in a very sort of unconscious way. I mean, doing a lot of damage, but the big question is whether there's any good to anyone coming from that, including the United States itself. And when there is no good, when the power is, you know, destroying for the sake of destroying, that's pretty dangerous, isn't it?
A declining superpower is always dangerous, especially if this declining superpower, the United States, has a mindset, deeply ingrained mindset, that it has to be the leader, that it has to give orders, it has to be the dominant player in the game.
There's a big difference between being a leader and giving orders, by the way. I mean, it's not the same thing, right?
The U.S. is a self-proclaimed leader. Nobody asked them to play that role, at least not the major countries. Huh? But it has played that role since World War II. And it's quite clear that it has been facing increasing difficulties in sustaining that superpower. No? So we are living through very turbulent times. Witness what is going on in Ukraine, what is going on in the Middle East. These are symptoms of the aggressive power, a power of destruction of a superpower that is in decline and fears its decline.
Now, and yet the IMF, the organization where you work, still goes by the word international. And to some extent, you know, it's reflected in its structure. I saw you writing in one of your articles that although virtually all sovereign states are formally represented at the IMF's governance structure, a small cohort of Western nation states representing 15% of the global population calls all the shots. And I was thinking about it in the context of the American elections when almost everybody gets to vote, but only, you know, a few get to wield real influence. I wonder if that's actually the sort of the root of the problem, that the Americans truly see that as democratic when you have a representative but not participatory governance system that they're pushing on pretty much the rest of all of us.
Well, my Indian colleague in the executive board used to say that the International Monetary Fund is a misnomer. It should be named the North Atlantic Monetary Fund, because really it's an alliance between the U.S. and its European allies that governs the fund. As the same holds for the World Bank. We used to hope, some of us used to hope, that over time the U.S. and Europe would be open to change, would come to realize that the institutions they created and control would only be viable if it becomes a more participatory structure. But what I saw there is a deep resentment, a deep resistance to any fundamental change. We can make some changes in the fund, in the World Bank. That's possible.
Cosmetic or nominal?
I wouldn't say cosmetic, but only to the extent that these changes do not challenge the control, the centralization of decision making in the small committee, which used to call itself the international community. It's, as you say, 15% or less of the total population of the world. And it behaves as though it's born to lead. It used to do it easily in the last centuries, but now this time is gone. The time has passed. And the Europeans, and especially the Americans, do not want to recognize this. They want to hold on to their power, to their privileges.
Well, to the title of power, but I get the sense that they don't actually want to be sort of burdened with the actual work of leading and governing, because it takes a lot of time and effort, as far as I understand.
Yeah, they want to dictate. They don't want to really have a dialogue. It's a dialogue of pseudo-dialogue in reality, what you see in the international organizations. They're no longer multilateral, except in name. They've become tools. I'll give you an example. The fund needs to support countries in difficulties. If the country in difficulty is seen as uncooperative by the West, it obtains no support, or support in very harsh conditions in terms of austerity. But if the country is friendly, or is geopolitically important to the West, it can receive an enormous amount of money with little conditions attached. So it's double standards all the time. The Americans and the Europeans, they feel they need to hold on tighter to the structures they have. And they're not willing to open space for the rest of the world.
Well, the rest of the world doesn't have to ask for their permission to open any space. And I mean, BRICS is one of examples of that. I mean, it wasn't created as a revolutionary force. It's not there to combat Western influence. At least initially, it was there to, you know, mind its own business and create better conditions for the member states. But whenever you try to set up a business in a monopolist environment, you are likely to be seen as a threat. And this is what I want to ask you about. Do you see BRICS as a challenger to the Western model, not in rhetoric, but in practice, in actions?
Well, you see, we always use the language of cooperation, peaceful negotiations. But the BRICS would never have been created, I can tell you that, if we had not sensed the fact that the West was unwilling to have a true dialogue with us. Initially, as you say, we were more inclined to work together, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and later
South Africa. In a very practical, non-political way. It's more practically.
We were working, I participated in that, working for the reform of the IMF and the World Bank. We managed to obtain some results, and then the thing got frozen. So after 2014, after 2012 in reality, we realized that we needed to build our own path. So we started constructing a new development bank. It's there, it's in Shanghai. We constructed the monetary fund of the BRICS, called contingent reserve arrangement. So we started doing practical things together. And now we are on our way, I hope, to building alternatives to the monetary system as well. And so I say, we are not anti-West. We never say we are anti-West. But of course, you never find a government official saying what I'm going to say now. But in fact, we sense the fact that we need to build something independent of the West. We can perhaps use the word not hostile to the West, but it's a counter-hegemonic force.
Alternative?
Alternative force. I think it is.
Can I ask you something? Because development is one of the words that pops up in many of those documents. IMF, World Bank, the United States likes to talk about it. BRICS also talks about it a lot. And what does development even mean in the current geopolitical context? Because I can remember a number of countries that had a fairly solid standing by the UN Millennium Development Goals, like Libya or Syria, which were declared pariah states and pretty much destroyed, supposedly for the benefit of their people. So what is development in the current circumstance?
I believe development in the current circumstance needs to be independent from Western structures, because Western structures have shown, you quoted two stark examples, Syria and Libya, but there are many others. What does this show? That you cannot develop if you don't have your own independent means. Economic, but also military. What is Russia showing? Russia is showing that the West cannot defeat it militarily.
But Russia is huge. I mean, Russia is a large country.
So large countries like Russia, China, Brazil, India can play a role in building, let's say, an umbrella where countries can develop peacefully and protected from the sort of destructive impulses that the West has. Huh? Especially the United States, it's something to be investigated more deeply, no? Why the U.S. behaves in that way.
But why? I mean, that's a good opportunity to do that. How do you understand this ultimate motive to come and impose some conditions on the country that do not only facilitate the actual, you know, humanistic development, but also oftentimes do not produce the results desired by the West itself?
The U.S. is a militaristic society. It has this militaristic mindset. Let me take, for example, day-to-day life in Washington, D.C. was very unpleasant. All sort of, you know, attrition. Even I'm talking outside the IMF. In the IMF, one thing I noticed which amazed me, even when Brazil had agreement with the U.S. on certain positions, agreement, it was difficult to work with them because they always think that they don't need support, they don't need alliances, they need facils, they need satellites. That's the way they think, unfortunately. So cooperation with them has become, I would say, practically impossible. Of course, governments, the Brazilian government cannot say that, but the Brazilian government and Brazilian officials and Brazilians in general know this from experience, huh? How difficult it is to negotiate and to deal with the United States because of their intrinsic attitude towards other countries.
Well, Mr. Nogueira, we have to take a short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
During World War II, the Germans, with the help of the Ustasha, the Croatian revolutionary movement that led the independent state of Croatia, transported hundreds of people to Norway to work in forced labor camps.
The Germans wanted the workforce to build roads and infrastructure in Norway. So when they couldn't get enough prisoners from Serbia, they contacted Ustasha. And in some of these camps, you had death rate up to 82%, which is actually higher than in Auschwitz.
Among them were dozens of children.
My deda Đorđe imao je brata Jovana. Tu je bio u logoru. Znači, kao 40-godišnji dječak došao u logoru Norvešku da bi ga 43. godine sa 16 godina streljali.
They had horrible conditions. Except from killings, many people died from starvation, hunger, as diseases.
Very few made it back home.
Ocu sam obećao davno da ću naći grob njegovog najmlađeg brata. Jeo me poslije 80 godina na njegovom grobu.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Paulo Nogueira, a Brazilian economist and former executive director at the International Monetary Fund. Now, Mr. Nogueira, as we've been discussing before the break, there's the West at one pole with its developmental model. And then on the other side, there are large countries like Russia, China, India, that I believe cannot be developed according to Western specifications. It's not only that they don't want to, but that it's not simply realistic, because that would be impossible without losing not just national identity, but national substance, because they are too large for the West to even offer them anything, you know, workable. But there are lots of countries in the middle. Do you think now is a good historical moment for those mid-sized countries to try to chart their own developmental course by themselves, or are they still in some way bonded to the sources of either financing or, let's say, technology?
Things are changing. If you look at the world now, you see a lot of middle-sized or even small countries that are moving away from the Western sphere. Look at what's happening in French-speaking Africa. A lot of countries are rebelling, expelling French forces, questioning French models of international relations. And I can tell you, from my experience, the French-speaking African countries used to be very disciplined with respect to France. Very, very much satellites. And now, 15 years later, I see the movement that's going on in Africa, in Latin America. It's a mixed bag, but you have the same situation. In Asia, the East Asian countries are developing at a very fast pace. Look at what not only China, but Southeast Asia. They did not follow the neoliberal agenda. They never followed it.
You know, the sense that I get is that there are a lot of countries who are truly dissatisfied with the system. They see it as unfair. They oftentimes see it as abusive. They like to criticize it. And yet they somehow lack the agency or the political will to offer, you know, their own solutions or to chart their own course. And they end up continuing relying on the abusive system and indirectly supporting it. What's the shortest way out of this somewhat sadomasochistic relationship that is still quite common in the international system?
No, you put it well. I agree with the way you summarized it. Let me just tell you that we cannot underestimate the United States and the West in general. They are declining in relative influence, yes. In relative economic size, yes. In relative demographic terms, yes. But they're still very powerful. They're declining from a very high stage of development and power. So why am I saying this? Is because if you look at the political economy of the countries in the so-called global South, most of them, perhaps all of them, are vulnerable to actions taken by the United States and their allies and its allies. I'll just give you an example. Recently, Donald Trump said that he would not agree at all with any attempt to unseat the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. And he even threatened countries that would try to do this with punitive tariffs of up to 100% on everything they import and export to the United States. Now, of course, you may say, well, Donald Trump is an outlier in terms of bluffs and aggressive statements, but I think we should make no mistake, the United States elite is deeply hostile to any attempt to unseat the dollar. And just to speak in my own country, I don't want to speak about other countries, Brazil has a lot of sectors of its society, in economy, in the political sphere, in media, in universities, which are deeply attached to the United States. They look up to the U.S. and they act in symphony with the U.S. when things become difficult. So it's not easy for a country, for even a government.
Well, you know, I study psychology, and it's interesting. There's an interesting parallel there that in stress times, we always sort of revert to traumatic ways of operating, the ways that we learn during trauma. But in good times, we can afford to advance some more productive ways. And I understand that Brazil, too, you know, at certain times can cooperate with China, with India, even with Russia, and, for example, settle, you know, their transactions in bilateral currencies. But I heard you say that while the countries, many countries are doing that on a bilateral basis, there is a limit to this sort of policy, because sooner or later there will come a time when they would have to set up not a common reserve currency, but a common reference currency. Why would that be needed? And what's the difference between reference and reserve currencies?
I'm glad you asked that, because this point is often misunderstood or overlooked. Last year here in Valdai, this point came up in certain interventions by the Russians present in the meeting, even by President Putin himself. I got the impression that some people think that settling, transacting in national currencies would be sufficient. We would need not go beyond that. But actually, that works poorly. Why? Because countries need to have a system where they can incur in deficits and surpluses. And you can't have that if you don't have, either you can call it a reference currency or a reserve currency. The point is that it needs to be a safe asset where you can park part of your reserves at least. Take, for example, the case of Russia and India. They transact mostly in national currencies. Now, Russia has a surplus quite large with India, so it's accumulating rupees. Now, the Central Bank of Russia may not want to hold on to these rupees because the currency of India is not convertible. It's perhaps prone to instability. So what can Russia do? It has some alternatives. None of them are good. None of them are perfect. Let's put it this way. It can seek investment opportunities in India, for example, using the rupees to invest in India. But that may be slow. India may be reluctant to open certain sectors of its economy to foreign investment. So Russia may try, alternatively, to increase its effort to import from India goods and services. And in turn, it may run into difficulties because it may want to protect certain sectors of the Russian economy against imports of goods and services. So what can Russia do? A third possibility, which has been used, is to do a triangular operation with countries, third countries that have interest in receiving rupees to use in their relations with India.
And who would that be? I mean, China and India would perhaps have some.
No, I was thinking mostly, for example, of the Gulf countries. And we have a lot of close proximity to India, and they need rupees. Well, what I say is this, by this example, it should just show that a system based purely on national currencies is a good step, yes, but it's not sufficient. So we need a reference currency. And another common misunderstanding, the reference currency is not a unified currency. It's not like a euro with a common central bank. That's not what's in being discussed. It would be a parallel currency for international transactions and to serve as a safe reserve asset for the participating countries.
Now, what would it take to come up with something like this? Because in rhetoric, at least, all the BRICS members and many of their associate partners are ready explore alternative ways of doing business, and they believe that it's their sovereign right to trade with one another, and yet for some reason the progress is halted at some point.
Well, you know, President Lula, who will chair the BRICS next year, Brazil will be the chair of the BRICS, has said in his statement in the Kazan summit, he said quite clearly, we need an alternative means of payment, not to replace our currencies, but to construct a financial system, a new financial system for the multipolar world order that we want to achieve. No? So he said that quite clearly.
He said that quite clearly, but do you think President Lula has enough, let's say, political courage to actually put his words into, you know, some action? No.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let's see. He formulated it clearly and correctly, but there is a problem. A problem is, going back to what I said before, the United States resists any attempt to unseat the dollar. The United States has power to influence backstage and front stage countries that may seek an alternative to the dollar. So you need to muster political will and technical capacity. What have we seen in the discussions among BRICS? Countries are reluctant to move forward. Russia made a very good proposal for a new settlement system as an alternative to SWIFT. Countries agreed to explore the issue, but they did not go beyond that.
Well, there may be some incentives offered by the United States itself, because its system is not only abusive, it's also deeply sick, and the American national debt is approaching $36 trillion as we speak. Do you see any reasonable treatment to that problem?
That's one of the reasons why we need an alternative system. The dollar, you see, a currency can only be trusted if the economy that issues that currency is also trustworthy. And the economy of the United States and other high-income countries is largely unstable. Fiscal deficits for the foreseeable future, high and growing debts, and the tendency to misuse the instruments as political weapons. So on the one hand, we realize this, we BRICS, I believe we do. On the other hand, we know, you know, the BRICS have a long entrenched tradition of working by consensus. This may be a trap for us, I believe. It's difficult to move away from this tradition because countries are
different, at different levels of
development,
different interests.
And they want their sensitivities and special concerns to be taken into account. So consensus has a lot of support. But what if we used to be five countries, now we're nine, and maybe more in the future. No? How can we work on the basis of consensus with a large number of countries, diverse and vulnerable?
Well, you can work on the basis of consensus if you understand what the common good really is. I mean, what you are there for, apart from talking.
But it's not only an understanding of common good, it's a political economy issue. Mm-hmm. Let me give you an example. Egypt is now a full member of the BRICS. Egypt is under an IMF program. So Egypt is very vulnerable to U.S. pressures in the execution of its, you know, if it's not cooperative with the West, it may face troubles in D.C., in the IMF.
Well, life is always challenging. You have competing motivations and competing risks. But at the end of the day, if we try to sum up the last 15 years of BRICS development compared to, let's say, G20, doesn't it look like BRICS has made some real progress forward compared, let's say, to the G20, because it seems to be sort of a talking shop.
Well, the G20, I also participated in the G20 since it became a leaders' forum back in 2008. The last relevant G20 presidency was the French one in 2011.
Well, it's prestigious, but not very effective.
But as you say, it's more a talk shop. And a talk shop that has become a sort of difficult because you have all the countries that are at loggerheads. You know, on the one hand, U.S. and Europe, on the other hand, Russia and China, and the Western countries boycott anything that involves Russia. So the G20 is broken. It's much less effective than the BRICS can be, you know? Or even the G7, in fact, is much more effective because it's a small, homogeneous group under U.S. leadership. The BRICS, I hope we do not continue expanding very quickly. And I hope we realize that consensus cannot be a golden rule. We need to, you know, build a coalition of willing countries. Let's say you want to move forward on the basis of the Russian proposal for an alternative payment system. Maybe not all countries would be willing to join. So let's construct a coalition of willing countries and move forward. The others can join later. My I know it's difficult. My concern is that if we stick to consensus rigidly with an expanding group, we may not get anywhere.
Well, if we stick, or if the BRICS countries stick to consensus, they would become as formalistic as the West, and perhaps they should learn from the West as well, from its own mistakes. Mr. Nogueira, we have to leave it there, but it's been pure delight talking to you again. Thank you very much for that.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.